Good morning, everybody. Let's make a start. We have a lot to do. It's already been pointed out that the sheet is long and the time is short. And the topic is, exactly, is pressing. So welcome, everybody. Choref Bari, Gesunte Winter, and whatever else I can bless you with for a successful and healthy year, Be'ezret Hashem ahead. We are back in business now after the Chagim. Some initial announcements. If I could just remind everyone, please, to turn off their phones. I say that every week, and that's our minhag, and every week we have a little tune, but if you could remember, that would be great. I'd like to thank the sponsor for the 2022 academic year. The sponsorship for all the shirim this year is anonymous, but in the as an aliyah for the neshamas of Brana Bas Bendit and Zelig Ben Kalman. Now, this is the season, if you remember from previous years, where I am in and out. I travel a lot, I recruit for my midrasha, which I run, which means that I will be here, please God, this week and next week. But then I will be away for a few weeks, three, I think, something like that. There will obviously be someone else who will be giving shiur here. And then I'll be back for a couple of weeks. And then I'll be away for a few weeks. And then it'll be Hanukkah. And then I'll be back for a bit longer, for a couple of weeks, and just be away maybe 1 week or 2 weeks. But by the time we hit the middle of January, we should be in business. Now you know exactly. Now you know why I've given you a lot to read. So I do want to tackle some interesting topics in the weeks that I am here. And the first one, which we looked at a few years ago, but if you remember, what we're doing in this series two is we're bringing a lot of new shirim, but we're also revisiting some of the things that we maybe looked at more quickly in the past. And I looked back 3 or 4 years ago, and we tackled this topic extremely quickly. And therefore, I wanted to go into it in a little bit more depth this week and next week. It is, of course, Parshas Bereishis, and the issue of creation, the age of the universe, comes up. But more specifically, science and Torah, more generally, perhaps, science and Torah. And also literal and non-literal readings of Bereishis, which is, of course, the key question here, which is, how literally are we meant to be reading the stories at the beginning of creation? Is it really about 6 days? Is it about a different period of time? Is it about a man and a woman and a snake? Or is it about other metaphorical ideas? Or is it about all of these things? It's literal plus allegorical or metaphorical. What does these words really mean? What are the boundaries of Orthodox theology on these things? At what point do you say, well, if you start saying this is not literal, then soon you'll be filling the dots for yourselves. So we're going to look a little bit at that today. Next week, I want to look at the other ways of resolving this question of the age of the universe, which are less perhaps controversial, but very interesting in and of themselves. We look at the issue of whether the 6 days are meant to be longer periods. We look at the issue of whether the world was created old. Some people expressed this in the 19th century with a question in Christian circles: did Adam and Chava have a belly button? Now, you may think that's a rather trite question, and from a Jewish perspective it is. It's a bit of a silly question to ask. But what they're really asking is, if Adam had a navel, then that's obviously evidence of a history that he didn't have. He wasn't ever in utero. Why does he need a navel? If he did, then maybe everything else is also created looking older than it really is. We'll look at that in some depth, those who support it, those who oppose it. We'll look a little bit at Gerald Schroeder's interesting thesis on physics and relativity as to whether the world is also, the creation was both 6 days and 13 billion years. And we'll also look at the other people who don't like that from a scientific and general perspective. So we'll look at all of that next week. So that's a lot for us to do next week. But this week we actually have a harder task. I am not going to try and read all the sources on the sheet. Even for me, this is a walloping sheet. 54 sources. And you can read them, please. Take them away, read them, and think about them. But let me just start with a bit of an overview as to what we're trying to achieve. Science and Torah are often perceived to be in contradiction to each other. Now, there may be lots of reasons why that perception is actually incorrect. First of all, historically, that was never seen as a problem. Up until around 600 or 700 years ago, science was really very much a discussion of both physics and metaphysics. if you'd have asked the Rambam whether there was a clash between science and Torah, he would have said, how can there be? Torah is min hashamayim, creation is min hashamayim, they all come from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. How can they even be theoretically in any contradiction to each other? So this is really a new phenomenon, new the last few hundred years, when we tend to define science by empirical, observable phenomena. If I can prove it, if I can repeat the experiments in a lab, that's what makes it science. Now, when you start talking about that, science begins to go off into a different direction. It's really nothing to do with metaphysics at all. It's certainly nothing to do with philosophy, and it's certainly nothing to do with theology. So that bifurcation, that split, happened over the last few hundred years. And now, if you ask anybody, they'll perceive this either as a clash or as an issue that cannot be resolved. But I'm going to suggest to you here that maybe that's a little bit of a misunderstanding. I brought you here, if there is an apparent clash, there are three basic approaches as to how to deal with it. Number one, maybe we misunderstood the science. Maybe the science is not as clear-cut as people think. Often when people... I'm not a scientist. My background is in literature and then in law and in Torah. So I can't talk about relativity with any kind of authoritative voice at all. But when we are presented science, it's often presented in a very simplistic, soundbite way. It's often much more complicated than that. And therefore, sometimes people are arguing from positions which are not very thought through. Certainly, much of the science that we hold today will not be considered to be accurate in 200 or 300 years from now. Does that mean all the science is wrong? No. But it sometimes can be seen as very absolute in a way that it's not. In particular, I brought you in little number two here, there's an issue of scientism. When people become almost dogmatic and religious in their belief in science to solve the world's problems. That becomes an issue of scientism, which is more than just a question of science itself. And I brought you here, I put this on this sheet, we didn't have it a few years ago. There is a debate that was set up by Time magazine a few years ago. It was in, I think, in the early 2000s, maybe a little bit before that even, between Richard Dawkins, who you may know as an eminent scientist who is a militant atheist, and Francis Collins, who is also an eminent scientist who is a devout Christian. And Time magazine set up this debate, and I leave it for you to read it for yourselves at the bottom here, where they talk about what they think about what is God and what isn't God. And Dawkins, obviously, is always very provocative. Later, he had a very famous debate with Rabbi Sacks, which I will reference a little bit later. This was an early debate with Collins, but you can read that for yourself as to scientism, when we believe that science has the answers, and they almost define science in a way that a religious person would say, well, that's God. What one line, for example, Dawkins says, who's the atheist, there could be something incredibly grand and incomprehensible and beyond our present understanding. To which Collins just said, yeah, that's God. And it's, no, it's not. That's not what I mean, etc. You can read it for yourselves. You can go online and see it in more detail. So maybe the science is less clear than we think. Maybe we're believing in science as a religion. Maybe we misunderstood the Torah. The Torah is often seen in a far too simplistic a way. Maybe they're both correct, but they're asking different questions. And that's what I want to start with, really. Rabbi Sacks had some very famous and great one-liners and more than one-liners on this. Here's a one-liner from number one. He wrote a book called The Great Partnership, which is one of the most important books to read on this issue. I really recommend it very strongly. I'm just going to quote a few lines from it. But that's perhaps one of the best stated analyses of the apparent contradiction between science and religion, which he says is not a contradiction. Science takes things apart to see how they work. Religion puts things together to see what they mean. It's a great one line. So too, number two, science is about explanation, says Rabbi Sacks. Religion is about meaning. Science analyzes. Religion integrates. Science breaks things down to their component parts. Religion binds people together in relationships of trust. Science tells us what is. Religion tells us what ought to be. Science describes. Religion beckons, summons, calls. Science sees objects. Religion speaks to us as subjects. Science practices detachment. Religion is the art of attachment. Self to self, soul to soul. Science sees the underlying order of the physical world. Religion hears the music beneath the noise. Science is the conquest of ignorance. Religion is the redemption of solitude. Very beautiful lines. Now, we're not going to give Rabbi Sacks a completely free pass today, because I am going to suggest it a little bit, that Rabbi Sacks overdoes it a little bit. and maybe even translates things in a way which pushes his own agenda, which I particularly, personally, I agree with his approach. But we'll see a little bit, slightly a critique on Rabbi Sacks as well. I think that Rabbi Sacks is a brilliant thinker on this, but again, not beyond some level of critique, which we'll see in a minute. I brought you here in number three, which we're not going to go into in depth, where he says, if you want to look at meaning, meaning can only be found outside the system. You cannot look at the system itself to ask, what does it mean? And so too with the world. You can't look at how the world works and use that to answer, what does it mean? You have to look beyond that. He brings a mashal of football. You know, people are mad about football. You can't look at the rules of football. Here I'm referring to English soccer, sorry. But it's true for anything. You can't look at the rules of a sport inside those rules and understand why people are so crazy about that sport. Why they pay vast amounts of money to go to games. Why they travel across the world. You need to look beyond football at sociology and anthropology and psychology to understand what football is. You can't understand it from the rules of football. And he uses that for religion as well. Well, he says you can't look at science to understand the meaning of things. You have to look beyond that. Having said all of that, just two last points. It's fascinating that science assumes something which is fundamentally monotheistic. Science assumes that everything fits together, that everything is meant to fit together. They're looking for that grand unifying theory, right? That can connect gravitational force with magnetic force and nuclear force, that connects everything. Why do they assume that it all fits together? Maybe it's all complete chaos. Maybe there's a polytheistic view, the wind gods fighting the moon god, and the moon gods fighting the stars and the stars. Science assumes no. Everything fundamentally works. That is actually a very Jewish monotheistic starting point, which itself bears thinking about. And secondly, it's remarkable that the universe works in a way which is, I put here, is on our wavelengths. Why can we understand math? How come our brains work in a way that makes sense of the universe? Now, you may just say, well, we just made sense of what we could make sense of, but actually we didn't make sense of most of it because we can't understand most of it. But it's fascinating that the universe is sufficiently complex to attract the greatest human brains, yet simple enough for them to succeed enough to want them, to keep them interested. It's just beyond us, but enough that we can grasp to keep us going. Okay, so that's all by way of introduction. There's a lot more to say, but let's get into the issues for now. First of all, the apparent contradiction is straightforward. The Torah says that Adam HaRishon was created 5,783 years ago. Where do we get that number from? That's a whole shiur in of itself. If you put together all the ages and all the dates and Seder Olam Rabbah, which is a midrashic work of Chazal, which is a sort of historical midrash on the Torah and post-Tanakh period, you get to that number 5783. Ah, there's 164 years missing from the Second Temple period. We've talked about that. Maybe it's not 5783. Maybe it's really 5946 47, something like that. Is that going to get you all excited because you think Mashiach's going to come by the year 6000? Who said Mashiach's definitely going to come by the year 6000? Not for now. But let's assume 5783 plus 6 days. And that's critical because it doesn't say that the universe was created 5783 years ago. It says that there's 5783 years from Adam, and then there's these 6 days of creation. Are they literal days? Are they not literal days? More about that next week. But that's the starting point. The scientists, however, are unanimous that the universe is enormously older than that. Even 150 years ago, they began to understand geology and see that it must be millions of years old, not thousands. And now, of course, we understand that it's billions of years old. The current figure is around 13.8 billion, which is, you know, arrived at through lots of evidence. And I brought you just, if you could look for a second, just glance at the last page of the sheet. This is some of the evidence that is brought to work out the age of the universe. They're not just guessing. There are multiple different cross-referencing things that date the universe to far, far more than 5783, put it that way. Now, having said all of that, this figure of 3.8 billion years is made on certain assumptions. And I'm not getting into this now because I'm not a scientist. Some of you may be more familiar with the science than I am. But it's based on something called the cosmological principle. The cosmological principle basically assumes that the universe is homogeneous, meaning it's basically the same everywhere, and it's also isotropic, which means that whichever way we look at it, the same rules of physics should apply in all parts of the universe. Now, we can't know that for certain. We're assuming that what we see is representative of what there is, and that the same rules that apply now apply elsewhere and previously. Now, it's not so straightforward that that is 100% agreed upon. And I brought you, if you go over to page 3, if you look at the bottom of page 3, I'm not going to read this either, but this is an extract from an article about 6-8 months ago in Quanta magazine. I don't know what that is, but it sounds very scientific to me. Maybe it's not. But it was an article about how they are now discovering certain things in far distant space that raise some questions about whether this cosmological principle is as tight as we thought it was. If you just look at the last line of this, it says here, as astronomers map the universe more precisely, however, a few researchers have started to wonder whether the field has pushed the cosmological principle too far. Large structures or lopsided features could undermine conclusions about the universe's age, behavior, and composition. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not suggesting that the scientists may turn around next week and say, oh, the universe really is 5,783 years old. No. But when they give you this number of 13.8 billion, don't assume that that is quantifiable, verifiable, in the same way that the Earth orbits the Sun rather than the Sun goes around the Earth. I don't think we're going to discover that actually the Sun really goes around the Earth, but we might find that that number changes considerably. And I brought you just at the top, Rabbi David Gottlieb has a great article, video on this, and he references this piece from the Rambam in the Guide to the Perplexed. Don't forget the Rambam was fighting against a much more serious scientific issue, which is Aristotelian physics understood that the world was eternal. And the Rambam was saying, no, the world is not eternal, the world was created at a certain point. And the argument he brings here is, you're assuming, Aristotle, that the way things work now are the way things worked at the beginning. But that is a false assumption, because he gives a moshel. Imagine there's a little boy that's born, and Nebuch, his mother, dies very soon after he's born. He's taken by his father to live with a colony of men, and only men, on a desert island miles away from anything else. And at some point when he's a teenager, he says, you know, where do we come from? And someone turns around to him and says, well, we grow inside the womb, and we're fed, intravenously by all the system of the uterus, etc. And the person says, well, that's ridiculous. Everyone can see that you have to breathe air, and you have to eat, and you have to drink. How can you argue something that is completely impossible? Because everything we've ever seen denies that possibility of a human being growing inside a womb. And of course, the mistake, says the Rambam, that he's making is he's assuming that the rules that he sees around him are the same rules at the beginning of the process. Maybe not. And that's kind of a comment on the cosmological principle as well. Maybe we shouldn't assume to the same degree that people think this is a cut and dried thing. It's not so straightforward, and we shouldn't certainly take science as the last word on everything. We should at least be questioning on how that works. But I'm not really here to talk about science. I'm here to talk about Torah. So let's have a look at some sources. Go to page 4. Now we'll look at these in more depth. The first, and in my personal opinion, most convincing approach to the apparent clash between science and Torah in terms of the age of the universe is the one that the Rambam takes and Rabbi Sacks takes, which is that when we read Bereishis, this also sees Rav Kook as well, we see Rav Dessler, when we read Bereishis, we're not meant to be reading it simply and purely literally, in a way that a fundamentalist Christian would pick up a Bible in English and says, the good book says 6 days, and if it says 6 days, it means 6 days. That's not how we read Chumash, ever, in that kind of fundamentalist way, and that's certainly not how we should be reading Bereishit. Let's have a look at some sources that indicate that. I brought you in 7, 8, and 9, just to whet your appetites for Shabbos, the extracts from the first 3 Rashis on Chumash. Rashi starts off famously, number 7. Amar Rebbe Yitzchak, lo yahayit tzarech la'atchel et ha-Torah ela me'ha-chodesh ezelechem. Torah means instruction. If the Torah is a book of instruction, it should have started with the first mitzvah. Here's instruction number 1. Make a Jewish calendar. In Shmot. Shehi mitzvah rishona shenitzdavu by Yisrael. This was the first of the mitzvahs. Matam patach bebreishis. Why do I even need Bereishis? Now, of course, Rashi has his answer. I'm less interested in his answer, which is focused on Eretz Yisrael, as the question, which is, what is this book for? It's meant to be instruction. Somehow we have to read Bereishis, Noach, Lech Lecha, etc., all through the book, stories of families, etc., as if they were, and they are, instructing us how to be better Jews. It's not history. We're not just reading it because it's history. It may be historical, but it's not being taught as history. It's not being taught as science. It's not being taught as philosophy. It's being taught as Torah. We'll see Rav Hirsch says that clearly. So Rashi's first question resonates across our whole shir. Why is this creation story here at all? It's not just here to tell us how the world was made. And Rashi says that clearly in the next source, number 8. In the second Rashi on the Chumash, says Rashi, Bereishis bara, Eina mikra hazeh omer ela darsheni. You can't read this pasuk without seeing that it must be darshan. There must be a deeper level on which it's to be read. Kamoshi darshu rabbi seinu zal, like the rabbis understood, bishvil hatorah. What does it mean, bereishis? The word in the beginning is berishona. Bereishis doesn't mean in the beginning. It means in the beginning of, he's going to get to that in a minute, but he understands it as bishvil reishis, bereishis. For reishis, the world was created. What is reishis? Bishvil ha-Torah. Shenikra reishis, reishis darko. Ubishvil Yisrael, shenikra reishis tvuato. Essentially what Rashi is saying is, the story of creation is not to tell us how the world was made, but why the world was made. That's the point. Bishvil ma, why are we here? Meaning, that's exactly where Rabbi Sachs was getting it from. And then he says, "V'im taima," if you want to claim lahorad ba she'elu tchilat nivru, if you really want to say that it's coming to teach the chronology, first this, then this, then this. U'perishu bereishis hakol, and you want to kind of add in the word hakol. Bereishit hakol, in the beginning of everything, bara. So that's how you want to make sense. And it is really a chronology. And it is telling us this, then this, then this. Im kein tama al atzmacha. Then you should be very surprised at how you came up with such a ridiculous question. Shahari hamayim kadmu. What's the first thing that we see that exists? Water. Yeah? It says, in the beginning, Bereishis bara elokim es ha-shamayim ve'es ha-aretz. But then we see there's water. Where did the water come from? Shahari ksiv ruach elokim rachevet al pnei hamayim. We've never seen where water was created, and yet it just seems to be there. Matai haita, when did that happen? Halamat shekadmu hamayim la'aretz, is he teaching us the water must have come before the creation, whatever water means. V'oche ha-shamayim, and also shamayim, what is shamayim made from? A later Rashi, eish umayim. Shamayim is made from eish umayim. Whatever these words mean, they were created from that. Al korchacha, therefore, it has to be loy limud hamikra seida hamukdamim u'mocharim klum. The Torah is not telling us any chronology. Not what came earlier, not what came later. It's a completely different purpose. Rashi is very clear that we should not be reading Bereishit in a way which is first this and then this in a chronological, certainly not scientific, way. And then number 9, to top it all, Rashi says, Bereishit bara Elokim, this is the third Rashi on Chumash, Lai ama bara Hashem, why doesn't it say bara Hashem? These are famous Rashis. Why does it use Shem Hashem, Yudke Vavke? Shebetchila ala b'machshava livrasa b'minis adin. Because originally, Hashem intended to create the world b'midat adin. Ala b'machshava, that's Shem Elokim. Rasha in Oilam Midkaim, he saw the world couldn't survive on that level, whatever that level is. And he therefore he included both Rachamim and Din. That's why it says in the second chapter of Bereishit, Behainu Dixiv, Beyom Asot, Hashem Elokim. We then see Hashem Elokim, Aretz B'Shamayim. So the whole of the first chapter of Bereishit, says Rashi, which uses the Shem Elokim, is actually not the creation itself, but it's the creation that rose in God's mind that he was going to create, but didn't in the end create. So what does that mean? I don't know. But it doesn't sound like it's something which is concrete. First this, first then that. Because the whole story, the whole account is there telling us a more philosophical point, a more theological point about Din and Rachamim. Therefore, I don't really know what I'm reading here in the first chapter in terms of what, quotes and quotes, really happened in physical terms. Let's look at a couple of different sources. For example, the Abarbanel here quotes the Rambam. with whom he disagrees, but he quotes him. The Rambam believed that there were not separate creative acts on 6 days, but rather everything was created on one day, in a single instant. We'll see that's Rashi's view, and the Ramban's view as well. In the work of creation, there is mention of 6 days to indicate the different levels of created beings according to their natural hierarchy. Not that they were actual days, nor that there was a chronological sequence to which this was created in the act of Genesis. This is the view of the Rambam, which he considers one of the major secrets of creation. Remember the expression Ma'aseh Breshit? Chazal referred to Ma'aseh Breshit as one of the deepest secrets of creation. If it's also straightforward, then what's so secret? What's so deep? He tried to conceal the view, but other commentators uncovered his secret and publicized his view. Gideon Barbanel doesn't like that view, but it's clearly the view of the Rambam. And I brought you Rav Dessler, which is a very different kind of source. Rav Dessler is not a philosopher. Rav Dessler is coming as a very classic source of Musa, an understanding Machshava, Hashkafa. Look in number 11. Says Rav Dessler, creation by definition is outside our world, outside our frame of thought. Just like the Rambam said in Morin Avuchim, what we see today is not what's going on. It was a different system. If time exists only as a mode of our thought, then the act of creation is necessarily non-temporal, above time. We'll get back to that next week. For example, the sun and the moon were only put in place on day 4. So what's a day? How does that work? So if the first few days are not classically days, because there's no sun and earth in juxtaposition, so what about the next 3 days? Are they also days or not days? We'll get to that next week. Every non-temporal act is interpreted in our frame of thought as an infinite time sequence. This is the reason why creation is interpreted by scientists as a process of evolution, extending over vast eons of time. We perceive it as billions of years. This is the reason, we just did that. Since creation does not take place in time, we must ask why the Torah describes it as taking 6 days. The answer is that the Torah wishes to teach us a lesson in relative values, almost exactly what the Rambam said. Everything has value only in relation to its spiritual content. Vast physical masses and vast expanses of space and time are of little significance if their spiritual content is small. The whole physical universe exists as an environment to the spiritual life of the human being. This is its spiritual content. While interpreting non-temporal creation in temporal terms, the Torah deliberately contracts the timescale comparted with that which presents itself to the scientist, in order to convey to us the relative insignificance of the material creation compared with the spiritual stature of man. It's a fascinating thesis, but what I'm bringing it for is to show you that he doesn't think it was 6 days. He thinks that the 6 days means something else. By the way, if you can ask the question, he talks about the vastness of the universe. Why, if the purpose of the universe is spiritual development of mankind, why does the universe need to be hundreds of billions of light years across? Why? Why do we need supernovae happening so far away that they couldn't possibly impact on our, insignificant lives? And the answer scientifically is fascinating, which is only supernovae with that kind of energy that's created by a supernova explosion can create the more complex elements like magnesium and strontium, etc., that are needed to create life. Meaning if it wasn't for the vastness of the universe, the only chemicals that would be around were hydrogen, helium, and simple chemicals after that, not the vastly complex, more complex atoms that exist because they've been produced in the crucible of a supernova. So if you want to know why stars are exploding at the other side of the universe, the answer is we're made of the stardust of those explosions. Without it, we couldn't exist, which is a fascinating idea in and of itself. It's enormously inspiring that, we have to exist. We can only exist, rather, through the explosions happening in the universe on an intergalactic basis. Okay, fine. So 6 days, not so straightforward. It's much deeper than that. Let's go even deeper. Page 5. Rashi. Rashi says, like we saw the Rambam says, clearly number 12, Yehi Morot. Miyom Rish Nivru, all these celestial beings on the fourth day, sun, moon, they were all created on the first day. Uberevi Tziv Aleim Le'elitalot Barakia. And on the fourth, they were put in place. Whatever that means, does it mean they were put there? Does it mean that from the perspective of man, he could now see them, or if there had been a man, because the clouds cleared, because the humidity of the atmosphere cleared? That's for next week. But they were put in place long after they were created. Everything was created on the first day. And then it was just put in place on the days that it needed to be organized. That's why it says, et ha-shamayim, the rabbis have told the same, which includes all the things that go with the shamayim, ve-et ha-aretz. Why doesn't it say, bereshit bara elokim, shamayim ba-aretz? Why, et ha-shamayim ve-et ha-aretz? On a drash level, he's saying it includes all of the contents of the universe, which was created straight away on the first instant, at least in potential, and then developed into the final system that he put in place. The Ramban takes this even one stage further to man. Look at number 13. Hapshat anachom b'milat na'aseh. Why does it say na'aseh adam b'tamim? These are all very famous questions. Who's God talking to? We, let us make man. Oh, that's what Rashi said. Ramban has a different pshat. We already understood. We already talked about this above. He says the Ramban. God only created yesh me'ayin ex nihilo at the very first instant. What's happening on day six is not creation; it's already been created. From those created elements, God then yatsar v'asa. Yitzur, in modern Hebrew as well, Yitzur is creation, it's forming something. Oseh is making something. Ukasha nasam b'mayim koach hashirutz. God gave the water the power, the potential to bring forth creepy crawlies. Lishrot nefesh chaya, to bring out those things that creep and crawl in the sea. V'haya mama b'hem yishrutzu hamayim. He says, God didn't create the sea animals like from scratch. Read the psukim. God says to the water, you create the sea animals, because I put the power within you to do that. So too, v'haya mama b'behema toitzeh ha'aretz. God doesn't create the animals, bang, bang, bang. God says to the land, bring forth animals. I've put within you the ability to bring forth animals. Now do it. I'm a ba'adam, and that's why he says, na'aseh with the man. Kloima ani v'ha'aretz ha'nizkeret na'aseh adam. I am going to make man together with the land. Not together with the angels, together with the land. Shetosi ha'aretz ha'guf, the land's going to produce a physical body, mi'yisodeha, from its natural elements, ka'asha asta b'behema v'chaya, just like it did with other animals. Animals, wild animals, domesticated animals, to the servants. It says, v'yitza Hashem elokim es ha'adam afar min ha'adama. It says the Ramban, don't have a picture of like making a golem, that God is bringing dust and dirt together and packing it. Even though Rashi suggests this kind of idea, putting water on it and making a model and then giving it the spark of it. Like, it says, no. God is saying to the land, first you create an animal, then v'yitzen hu yisparach haruach mipi elyon. Then God will give it what no other animal has, which is v'yipach ba'pav nishmas chay. Fascinating. Much more complicated than we thought. And the Sforno even says it explicitly, number 14, v'yipach ba'pav nishmas chayim, nefesh chiyunit, what does it mean he gave him this living force? Muchenet l'kabel tzelem elokim. First God created him with a life force which was capable of receiving the tzelem elokim. Mikol makam, but nevertheless, at that stage, Adam was not yet Adam. V'yihi ha'adam l'nefesh chaya. Adam was a nefesh chaya, says the Sforno. Chaya am im kol zeh chaya bilvad. Man was still an animal. Bilti medaberet, unable to speak. Ad shenivra b'tselem udmud. And then God puts in the power of spirituality, then mankind can speak, etc. And he's changed from being an unspeaking animal into a speaking human being.
It's together how some people explain that there were really people like creatures before Adam.
We'll get to that. We'll get to that right now. Before we get to the hominids and whatever people beforehand, at least you see from here that the creation of man is much more complicated than we think. The animal's bringing forth a creature, and man is a creature until God puts into man the power of speech and turns him into a human being. And your point, Itamar, is exactly what I was coming on to right now. The Gemara in Shabbos says that there are 974 generations before the creation of man. What's 974 generations before the creation of man? It's based on a pasuk that says there are 1,000 generations up to Matan Torah, 26 generations from Adam to Moshe, must be 974 before Adam. Now, it could be, it is obviously symbolic in different ways, but if you look, I brought you a couple of things here. Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan says, Adam was merely the first human being created in the latest cycle. We'll get back to the cycles next week. According to these opinions, it would seem that man had already had the physical and mental capacities that we possess as early as 974 generations before Adam, or some 25,000 years ago. That's fascinating. Were these people wandering around on the planet? Were Adam and Chava the first real spiritualized people, but there were a whole group of other lower level spiritual people wandering around? That's an interesting idea. If so, it would explain certain things which are less clear. For example, Cain is worried when he kills Hevel that wherever he goes, he'll be killed. Someone will kill him. Who's going to kill him? Mum? Dad? They're not going to kill him. So Rashi says, the animals will kill him. But maybe there are other people around who would react negatively to Cain as a murderer. Then Cain goes and builds a city. He builds a city.
For who?
A very big empty city. Unless there are maybe other people around, etc. There are questions that come up which may be explained in this way. And the Rambam himself says in number 17, Adam lived 130 years and he had a son in his own likeness, etc. That's the Pasuk. As regards the words, the form of Adam and his likeness, we've already stated that those sons of Adam who were born before that time were not human in the truest sense of the word. They didn't have the Tselem Elohim. So even Adam and Chava were giving birth to lots of subhuman humans who are not really, whatever really means, human. And therefore, there's a lot more going on here beyond the first glance, clearly, and underneath the surface. Let's get into the real question here in the last 25 minutes, though, which is, how far do I take this? Yes, there are lots of sources. It's much more complicated than we think. But to what extent can we turn around and say, well, maybe there's no literal interpretation? Meaning to suggest that there are deeper layers, that's not controversial. Suggest that there's pshats and remez and drash and sod and other ever deeper and deeper levels. But can you ever turn around and say, it's not literal at all. It's just not meant to be taken literally. As opposed to, it's beyond literal. So I brought you a few sources here which I think are much more complex than we can deal with in 25 minutes. But first of all, I brought you Rav Sajigon. Rav Sajigon, and I went into this in more detail in the past year, which I've referenced in the bottom here. Rav Sajigon says that his presumption is that the Torah is literal unless there's a very good reason why it's not literal. By the way, the presumption with Midrash is the opposite. Midrash, certainly according to many, many, many commentators, the presumption is it's not literal. Otherwise, you're not taking it seriously. If you think it just literally means the sun spoke to the moon and the moon spoke to the grass and the grub, then you're not taking it seriously. But with Psukim, says Rav Sajigon, there has to be a good reason for it not to be taken literally. And he gives four reasons. If you look at number 18, he gives four reasons there. Either because it's like obviously not, it's obviously an exaggeration. You know, Eve was the mother of all living things. Well, no, she wasn't. It means all human beings, clearly. That's easy. But number two is the difficult one. Or else the literal sense may be negated by reason. It can't be literal because reason tells us it's not. For example, the Lord your God is a devouring fire. It's a poshet. Pasuk. Eish ochla. Now fire is something creative and effective, for it's subject to extinction. Oh, God is a fire? Wow, that's a whole new theological take. We can put fire out. Can we extinguish God? Chas v'shalom. Hence, it's logically inadmissible that God resembles it. It can't be literal, because our reason, our machshava, our understanding of what God is, tells us that can't be literal. The Rambam makes a lot of this when he gives anthropomorphic understandings of God. God sees, God hears, God stands. That doesn't mean that God does these things physically, obviously. Yad chazaka, zroa netuya. These are not physical things. How do we know? Oh, you've got to take Pesukim literally. No, because reason tells us this cannot be literal. Now, reason's a very interesting thing. How far does reason go? We'll see in a minute. Well, good, so we'll see. So first of all, look at 19. We'll see why Rav Sajigon has a presumption of literalism. It is not admissible that a verse of scripture be construed in any other sense than its literal sense, except for one of the four reasons mentioned by us previously. I didn't go through all four, you can read it yourself. Where, however, none of these reasons exist, the verses are to be taken in their explicit meaning. Taken literally. Why? For if it were necessary to construe every verse of sacred writ, sorry about the translation here, in whatever figurative sense is possible without compelling proof, not a single revealed law would be maintained, since they are all capable of such non-literal interpretation. What's he worried about? He's worried about you're going to do with the Tanakh what the Christians did with it. They said, it's not meant to be taken literally. The Old Testament is not literal. They have the meanings here, anagogical and allegorical and moral and literal. Meaning, and I brought you in the footnotes here, the things that he's worried about. He says, for example, you could turn around and say, you can't light fires on Shabbos. That really means you're not allowed to fight battles on Shabbos. But that's not what he means. He means you can't light fires. You can't eat chomes on Pesach. Maybe that's a prohibition against adultery. So you can't start with us. Once you start taking everything in a non-literal way, then there's no more Torah. There's no more halacha. No, it doesn't make any sense. All the mitzvahs that God's saying, do this, do that, it implodes in a nonsensical way if there's no literal meaning to those things. So he's worried about you undermining the halachic process. However, that doesn't mean, as he said, everything is to be taken literally. It means that there are strict rules as to what can and what cannot. And I brought you here two quotes, one from the Rambam and one here from Rav Sacks. And we'll see that I think Rav Sacks may go a little bit too far. In a minute we'll see where he goes, in my humble opinion, too far. Look at the Rambam. You surely know, number 20, that many verses in the Holy Law are not to be taken literally. Interesting, many verses. Since it's known through proofs of reason that it is impossible for the thing to be literally so. The translator, the Targum, therefore renders in a form which reason will abide. A man should never cast his reason behind him, for eyes are set in front and not in the back. Meaning, obviously, if it can't possibly, according to reason, be taken literally, you mustn't. So, based on that, Rabbi Sacks, in the Great Partnership, says in number 21 the following. The view of Sa'adia, shared by all the medieval philosophers, actually that's itself not so straightforward, is that when a biblical text is incompatible with either reason or observation, that is sufficient evidence that is to read it figuratively, allegorically, poetically, or in some other way. Reason and observation, later to become the methodology of science, were regarded as reliable bases of knowledge, and it was taken as axiomatic that the Torah could not conflict with established truth. Now, Rabbi Sacks has gone a bit further there. He's saying, if science tells us that this cannot be literally so, we have to reinterpret Torah in accordance with science. That's what he just said. Now, leaving aside all the things we said at the beginning, how does science know for sure? Are we going to all look foolish when the science changes? Meaning, if they'd have, that the Rambam says in the Morin Nebuchim, I could reinterpret the Torah to match with Aristotle and the eternity of the universe. I could. But I'm not going to, because I'm not sure it's correct anyway. But how far do we go with this? I brought you in the footnotes here two sources. One from Rabbi Moshe Meiselman. Rabbi Moshe Meiselman, who you will probably know, he's the Rosh Yeshiva in Taras Moshe. He was one of the main opponents of Rabbi Natan Slifkin. When Rabbi Slifkin, we had the whole controversial debate in 2004-05, which Rabbi Slifkin catalogues in great detail on his websites. So Rabbi Meiselman was one of the most outspoken critics of Rabbi Slifkin, and he's also a critic of Rabbi Sacks. He says, that's not true, it's not fair, it's not correct to say that science is the determinant of how we interpret Torah. And I think in this sense, Rabbi Meiselman certainly has a point. What exactly did Rabbi Sacks mean here? I brought you a quote here from Professor Menachem Kellner, who I'm a big fan of, as I said before, where he quotes, says, to all intents and purposes, science becomes our measure for understanding the Torah. It's also a strong statement, which I think is not altogether supported by the sources that he brings. There's more to be said about that. I refer you to Rabbi Kellner, Professor Kellner's book, which is an excellent book, Science in the Beit Midrash, where he goes into this. We'll get back to this in a few minutes. But I'm just saying you can't just make straightforward statements that the Torah has to be reinterpreted in accordance with science and leave it at that. Having said all of that, of course, we know that the Torah is meant to be interpreted as poetry. That's a given, and everybody agrees on that. If you look, for example, there's a famous quote, number 22. I know rabbis say everything's famous, but this one really is famous. Usually just means that they read it. It's in Sanhedrin. It's actually in Lamed Daled. It's not in Lamed Aleph. That's a mistake. It says as follows. The Rabbi Shmuel Tana, Ukepatish Yufotsetz Sala. Like a rock explodes the hammer. Ma patish ze mitchalek lekama nitzotzot. Just like a hammer, when you smash it on a rock, splinters into many pieces. Af mikra echad yodze lekama ta'amim. So too, a posuk has many, multiple meanings. Now, actually, very interestingly, is the metaphor is actually not that the rocks, the hammer smashes the rock, but that the rock smashes the hammer. Which is interesting. I only realized this a few days ago, and Tosfos actually talks about that. And it may be that it's not the Torah that gets splintered, it's our perspective on the Torah. We are the hammer knocking against the Torah, and it's us that gets splintered into different ways of thinking, because the Torah changes us and acts on us, which I think is a fascinating idea. There are other gersos that the rock gets splintered, but that's not for now. But the idea that there's multiple meanings is fundamental. The Torah is called a Shira. Calls itself a Shira. And I brought you a foundational piece by the Netziv. The Netziv, the Rosh Hashiva of the Lozhen. You can't have better religious credentials than Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, Rosh Hashiva of the Lozhen through the most of the mid-19th century. He used to give a Chumash Shir, which later became his Haimek Davar, Perush on the Torah. And in the introduction, he says that the Torah calls itself a Shira because when you're reading poetry, you read it differently than how you read prose. And he says in a number of ways, beteva ubeskula. He says, first of all, the nature of poetry is that it assumes that you know other things. You bring other outside information in. If you just read a Shakespeare sonnet and take it, on a simple chat level, shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. And you say Shakespeare's, talking to his girlfriend or his friend. I'm not getting into whether it was a girlfriend or another kind of friend for now. Okay. But if you just take it on a simple level, then you won't get a very good mark in your English literature, dissertation. You have to bring in ideas from here, and this is a reference to here. This is a reference to channeling Hamlet, and this is channeling Macbeth. And this is, okay, good. Well, it doesn't say that. No, but it's written as poetry on the assumption that you bring in outside information. It says then it says, Lahavdil, the Torah is written even more so. If Shakespeare, Lahavdil, can write with that depth, then HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when he writes the Torah, gives us the Torah, we must expect infinitely more depth. And therefore, we're expected to read it like Shira. And he says at the end of the first paragraph, V'lo nikra drush, and that's not called drush. Alakachu pshat. It's not, oh, that's drush. You're learning in all sorts of metaphor. No, that's pshat. That's how I'm meant to read the psukim, like a poetry, like poetry and not like prose. And then he also says it has this segula. Poetry has certain inner qualities. It's sometimes acrostic. It's coded aleph bet gimel daleth. There's the name of the author. He says sometimes when you're writing a poem, you use words in an unusual order in order to make a meter or make a rhyme. So too with the Torah. It says words in an order, which is not perhaps the most obvious order, but because there's a deeper inner code that you need to be getting that you're not getting if you don't read it as poetry. So Torah has to be read as poetry. Of course, whenever you're reading any text, you're always asking the question, what am I trying to get out of this? Am I trying to understand the intention of the author? Well, good luck with that one, since the Torah is min ha-shamayim. You're not going to get too far on that. The understanding of the people that it was initially given to. I'm meant to be reading the Torah the way that B'nai Yisrael would have read it, or no. Or am I meant to be reading it the way that every generation objectively would read it? Or every individual subjectively would read it? Does the Torah mean what I think it means? And what are the lines? These are very important questions. How do you read the American Constitution? The legal system in America interprets the Constitution to mean things that the founding fathers would never in their wildest imagination have thought were included. But maybe that's okay.
It works both ways, though. Now in America, the whole wave of condemning people from previous generations because they didn't have the same rationale and reasoning that we have today.
Right. It doesn't say much for our hopes for the future generations on us, does it, really? Because if that's what we do, then so too we will be done to in that way. So there are multiple poetic meanings to the posuk. On the other hand, there's lots of hands here. Go to page 8. Ein mikra yotzei midei pshuto. There's always a pshat. And there's a statement in the Gemara in Shabbos, Amar Rav Kahana, Kad Havino Bar Tam Nisrei Shanin, I was 18 years old already, and I learned the whole Talmud, and I didn't realize until this point, Now that's interesting. How was he learning it before that? Did he think that there wasn't always a pshat? Now he realizes there's always a pshat. So there's always a pshat. But as the Nitziv said, pshat is not that simple. In fact, Rabbi Chaim Angel, I think, wrote a book called Pshat is Not That Simple. Because pshat, I ask my students sometimes, what does pshat mean? And they say, simple. No, it's not simple. Simple, like why is everybody disagreeing what pshat is? Literal. Really? Yad chazaka v'zroa netuyah, that's the pshat that God has a hand? No. Pshat's very complicated, certainly when it comes to the issue of Bereishis. And let's maybe move on to that now. For example, I brought you in 30 and 31. 30 is the Sforno. What is the snake? What is the snake? Says the Sforno, number 30, v'hanachash, beginning of chapter 3, Hu Satan, Hu Yetzahara. The Nachash is the Satan. That's what the Nachash is. Rakahezek imuat heitod nira. You only see a little bit of potential damage, but it's going to be much more damaging than you think. Ki amnon yikra adava b'shem ezid domila. Because sometimes things are called by metaphorical names. Kamosha nikra hamelech Aryeh. The king is called a lion. Kamra says in Yirmiyahu, ala Aryeh misvuka. The misuvka. The lion is coming out from its thicket. It's not a lion, it's a king. It's called a lion. Sometimes our enemies are called snakes and serpents. Which cannot be charmed. They're not really snakes and serpents. That's a word we use. So too, he says, al derech, al zeh haderech. In this way, karabazeh amakom ez ha-yetzahara hamachti nachash. So the Yetzahara is given the name nachash. It's not a snake. It's the Yetzahara. B'yosa dome l'nachash, it's like a snake. How so? Asher to'alaso b'miyitzuz mu'ez, it doesn't seem to be doing anything bad. Mu'ed mod, it seems to be very tiny. V'nisko rav, but it's got so much damage that it's done in the end. It's not a snake. If you think the story is about two naked people and a talking snake, you've completely missed the point. Comes along the Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra, of course, was before the Sforno, but what the Sforno said was being said by many others. The Ibn Ezra says, okay, we've got a talking snake here. What are we going to do with a talking snake? And don't forget that when Bilam's donkey talks, the Chumash goes out of its way to say, it was a miracle. God opened the mouth of the donkey. It's a miracle. The snake seems to talk because, well, it's poshut. Snakes talk. It's obvious. It's not a miracle. That's what's driving people to think this is obviously not an ordinary snake. It's not a miraculous occurrence. The Ibn Ezra says, no, it's a snake. Yesh omnim ki ha'isha haita mivina, number 31, the woman understood v'yodad loshen ha'chayas. The woman could speak parcel tongue. And she understood the way that snakes speak. V'yifreshu v'yomeh ha'nachash b'remiza, so she could get what the snake was saying. V'achem amru shehu satan. There are people, he says, that say it's not a snake. It's the satan. The Eich lo yiru soifa parsha, but why did they not read to the end of the parsha? Ki Eich yelech ha-satan al-gachayim, how can the satan walk on its belly? The snake was told, you'll be walking on your belly, you'll be crawling on your belly. The Eich yachal afar, how is he going to eat dust? The satan doesn't eat dust, it's obviously a snake. Ma tam leklalas, v'hu yishufacha roish, that he will crush your head. Satan doesn't have a head. The Hayashir Beinai makes much more sense, as the Ibn Ezra, Shehem Dvarim Kamashma'am. You have to take this as it sounds. It's a snake. The Hanachash Hayim Adaber, the snake could speak. Vayaholech Bekum of Zekufa, and Bekum of Zekufa. It walked like on two legs or four legs or whatever. The Hasam Dat Ba'adam Sambo, and just like God puts knowledge in a person, God put knowledge in the snake. Then Apostle Heda Ki Ha'arum Mikol Chayes, etc. So the Ibn Ezra says, no, you have to say it was a snake. The Sforno says, absolutely not, it's not a snake. So who are you going to go with? If a snake is not a snake, is the tree a tree? Is the garden a garden? Is the flood a flood? Is the ark an ark? Where are you going to draw those lines? So I've given you lots and lots of sources to tell you, to give you some ideas as to how this might work. First of all, I'm not going to read all of these. Rav Hirsch, number 32, says, this is a very important quote, maybe I'll read this one out. Before we open the Torah, says Rav Hirsch, let us consider how to read it. As a subject of philological or antiquarian research, I think you're meant to shout, no, there, but please don't, because, you know, but you know what he's saying. So rhetorical questions. As corroboration for antediluvian geological hypotheses in the expectation of finding revelations of esoteric mysteries, certainly not. As Jews, we will read the book, as a book tendered to us by God, in order that we learn from it about what we are, what we should be during our earthly existence. We read it as Torah, literally instruction, directing, guiding us within God's world, among humanities, making our inner self come alive. Very important words. We have to read a book as Torah, not as other scientific or academic ideas. And Rav Kook, here in number 34, says everybody knows that creation is much deeper than it looks, that this is the area which is the most open to parable, allegory, allusion, etc. And this actually is specifically said by the Rambam. Have a look here in the Rambam in number 35. The account given in Scripture of the creation is not, as generally believed, intended to be taken in all its parts literal. Ooh, some yes, some no. The literal meaning of the words might lead us to conceive corrupt ideas, to form false opinions about God, or even entirely abandon and reject the principles of our faith. If you read it literally, you might go off the derech. It is therefore right to abstain and refrain from examining the subject superficially and unscientifically. It is, however, right that we should examine the scriptural text by the intellect after having acquired a knowledge of demonstrated science and the true hidden meanings of prophecies. And in 36, I brought you a Rabbi Sachs' translation, which I looked into in some detail. Look at what he says of the Rambam. Now, on the one hand, the subject of creation is very important. But on the other hand, our ability to understand these concepts is very limited. Therefore, here's the key line. God described these profound concepts which his divine wisdom found necessary to communicate to us using allegories, metaphors, and imagery. Now that's interesting. Allegories, metaphors, and imagery. That's Rabbi Sachs' translation. Allegories and metaphors makes a lot of sense, mamashalim v'chidot, but Rabbi Sachs uses the word imagery to translate the words dvarim stumim. And Rabbi Meiselman picks him up on this and says, Dvarim Stumim doesn't mean imagery. Not what it means. It means something which is very unclear, something which is very obscure. And therefore, why is Rabbi Sachs using the word imagery here? And I mean, I'm sure he would be able to defend himself, but he translated this source entirely according to the Friedlander translation, apart from that word which he changed to imagery. Okay, fine. Having said all of that, I personally feel that Rabbi Meiselman's greater thesis is less convincing. He says, for example, the Rambam says very clearly in Morin Avuchim that he takes certain things literally. Yes, and the Rambam says in the introduction to Morin Avuchim that he will purposely say things which are not what he really believes in order to throw you off the scent if you're not a sophisticated enough thinker. So you can't say that the Rambam explicitly says something in Morin Avuchim. It's obviously more complicated than that. Where does this leave us? Where does this leave us? I brought you 39 and 40, which I would like to point out to you and you can read on your own. Magid has brought out a significant number of excellent translations and books about Tanakh. And two of them are a book by Rabbi Dr. Svi Gromit, who I don't personally know, who wrote a book in 2017 called From Creation to Covenant. And also a translation of a sefer by Rabbi Dr. Yoni Grossman, who I do personally know, he lives in Ayishuv, which is about Bereshit. Now, if you read those, they both deal very clearly with the issue of how literal is literal and when do I stop. For example, Rabbi Shubert Sparrow, who I don't know, who some of you may know, you know, Avmeir Ve'eshrim, I think he's very...
Just turned 99,
definitely Avmeir Ve'eshrim. He wrote an article in 1999 which got him into some trouble. He said, for example, that real history, his words, begins with the Avos. Real history begins with the Avos. So Noach and Genesis and Bereshis are not yet real history. So Rabbi Grommet and Rabbi Grossman both developed those themes. And again, I really suggest that you read them in depth and read the whole introduction, the whole book. Rabbi Grommet goes further. He says he thinks that Bereshit is prehistory. And he says explicitly, whether such a period actually existed or is used as a metaphor is less important than the fact that the description of the period is Antoninus too, which is actually what Rav Kook said. He then calls the Avos proto-history, which means these were real historical people, but we're learning about their lives to learn a much deeper idea. And then he says the historical era begins in Sefer Shmos. Again, don't just take my 5-second summary as being everything he says. Read it in the source, read it in the original. But he goes quite a long way to say that he thinks you don't have to take Bereshit at all in a literal way. Or whether you do or don't is not that important. Rabbi Grossman won't go that far. Rav Yoni Grossman, who is not afraid to be radical in the way he reads Chumash, he says he thinks the correct word is not a parable, but a symbol. In Hebrew, he said it's not a mashal, it's a semel. And a symbol means that you have the literal meaning and also a symbolic meaning. And he wants to keep these as historical events. Again, what exactly does it mean that Adam lived in a garden? I don't know, but it was a historical reality. But it also is deeply symbolic. So those two books, I think, are well worth a read. I brought you the Rav Kook that I mentioned before that says, it doesn't matter, he says explicitly in one of his letters, it doesn't matter if mankind began in a utopian garden or started as a micro organism that evolved over billions and millions of years. It doesn't matter. What matters is Bereshit tells us that we can be on the highest level and we can make one mistake which is so disastrous that it brings the whole of our lives into catastrophe. So he actually says it quite clearly. I brought you a few sources on, is Gan Eden a physical place? Which you'll be interested to know that the Rambam in the Perashat Mishnah says, yes it is. He says, it is a physical place, we just don't know where it is. Which is an interesting idea. I brought you the Ramban as well. Just finally, I'll point out, maybe a little cheekily, if you look on page 13, I brought you a subheading, Where Are the Lines of Orthodoxy and Heresy? Okay? Now, who am I to draw lines? But I'll mention to you that Rabbi Spero, in 1999, wrote this article, and he got quite a lot of kickback. For example, in number 50, Rabbi Daniel Eidenson, who I know quite well, he said it's problematic, and you can read what he says, it's problematic. You're taking things metaphorically that Chazal seemed to take literally. Didn't Chazal talk about the flood in a literal way? The animals, it was this big and it was this wide, etc. This fellow, Yitzchak HaKohen, who I don't know, I'm sure he's a delightful individual, is a little bit more scathing. He writes, number 51, there seems to be an inherent contradiction on the cover of Tradition, volume 33. The subtitle reads, A Journal of Orthodox Jewish Thought. And yet the title of the first article by Rabbi Shubert Sparrow asked if the stories of Gan Eden and the flood were metaphors. Hardly Orthodox Jewish thought. Okay. And then he says the articles conclude that they were metaphors. And then he says, unfortunately, Rabbi Sparrow's article is based on obsequious acceptance of the latest theories of evolution and cosmology as absolute truth. Such faith is unwarranted, for as many writers have recently shown, these theories are based on mere information, massive conjectures, that's science. The only absolute faith which a Jew should have is in the truth of the Torah, within the bounds of legitimate interpretation based on Chazal and Rishonim. Sadly, this seems to have been neglected by Rabbi Sparrow. To which Rabbi Sparrow responded, finally, in a personal note to Mr. HaKohen, while I am prepared to accept Musa from anybody, anyone, it will be more helpful if it zeroed in on my true weaknesses. Which I think is a good line, actually. Happily, an obsequious acceptance of the latest theories of evolution and cosmology as absolute truth is not one of them. Nor does anything I've written over the last 52 years, now read 72 years, reflect such a belief. What is truly sad is that so many of our literalists do not realize that in their holy zeal to save the Torah for orthodoxy, they are actually darkening the light of the Torah and distorting its truth. And that is not a metaphor. That's a good line. I felt a little bit chutzpahdig bringing this on the sheet, but it's in the public domain. You can read it for yourselves. And I brought you in on page number 53, which I'll just mention now, and I won't read, an article by Joshua Golding on the limits of non-literal interpretation of Scripture from an Orthodox perspective, which is very worthwhile reading. And he basically says there, he expands on Rav Sadigon. Rav Sadigon was worried that if you take things in a non-literal way, you'll undermine halacha. And he sets out there, in a broad sense, four givens that make the Orthodox system of halacha orthodox, which he listed, I put them at the bottom of the page. And he says, once you start explaining things in a non-literal way, in such a way as to undermine these givens, then that's gone too far. That's crossed the line. You can say that the snake is not a snake. That doesn't undermine in any sense the hashkafas and machshavas of Orthodox Judaism. But to say that Yetziat Mitzrayim, God forbid, is a mashal for something, that undermines everything. Because therefore it's not a legitimate interpretation. You can say that what we read in the Psukim is not exactly word for word how it happened, but how God presents it. Okay, fine. When Paro speaks to Yosef or to Moshe, I assume he spoke in Egyptian, right? Fachazal say he didn't know Hebrew. And the Chumash puts it in Hebrew. So if I'd have been standing there, I assume I would not have heard those words. I'd have heard different words. But that doesn't matter. It happened, but it's the Torah is presenting it in a way that we need to understand. So there's so much more to do. And I hope that I've just begun to, you know, scratch the surface. But these are the sources that I'm aware of, which are the places to go. So good luck with that. You can look them up over Shabbos. You can find most of these articles online. Next week we'll get into the relatively safer, but no less complicated, issue of whether the 6 days were 6 days. And we'll talk a bit more about that. Okay? Have a wonderful week. And we'll see you, please God, soon.